Welcome back to the Film Experience Podcast. This is your host, Nathaniel R. This is our third monthly SmackDown companion, so we're going to be discussing 1989, which we've the year of the month, so to speak, and we're looking at the supporting actress nominees, and on this podcast, we're going to delve a little further into their films. So that's My Left Foot, Enemies, A Love Story, Parenthood, and Steel Magnolias. This is part one of our conversation, and allow me to introduce our panelists, beginning with Tasha Robinson at The Dissolve.
Hello.
So start memorizing everyone's voices. Next, we have Todd Vanderwerf from Vox. You used to know him from the AV Club. He recently moved.
Yes, I just did. Hello.
Next, we have Tim Roby from The Telegraph.
Hi.
And Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks.
Me again.
And Kevin B. Lee from Keyframe and, well, a bunch of other sites, right?
Yeah, I sort of hang my hat. Keyframe, they send the biggest checks, so I'll associate my name.
That's so. This month we looked at the films nominated for Best Supporting Actress in 1989, and you've read the SmackDown, and so we want to talk a little bit more about the performances to flesh out, you know, some of our comments as well as the films themselves, so you get a little deeper view of what we're talking about. So to get started, what I'm curious about is it's pretty clear from our voting, since we do, in addition to the caption, you have to, like, give a star rating. And it's pretty clear from the voting that Kevin would have voted for Lena, Tasha would have voted for Diane Weiss, but everyone else has, it's a little less clear. So, like, my vote, for example, I gave two people four hearts with Diane Weiss and Lena Olin. My vote would have gone to Diane Weiss. And this is the first time at a SmackDown where I've really desperately wanted to use half stars because the performances weren't all over the place for me. They were all good. so that it was a little hard to decide who was better. I don't know if any of you have struggled with that, but Todd, who would you have voted for?
You know, I suspect I would have fallen for the old Oscar voter trap of voting for the person that I thought, you know, was in the movie I liked better, so I probably would have ended up voting for Brenda Fricker. But I did really like Angelica Houston as well, and I could have seen myself being swayed by that. I don't remember the other person who had a tie, so you're going to have to remind me, Nathaniel.
No, those were the two that you had with your higher rating.
Oh, okay, great.
So how about you, Tim?
Yeah, I had a triple tie, and I would say that both Angelica and Diane were kind of like 3.5s that I rounded up, mm-hmm. whereas Brenda was pretty squarely a 4, so I think I would have ended up voting for her, yeah.
Okay. And Nick?
I struggled with this too, but I think I also would have fallen into the Oscar voter trap of voting for the person who didn't seem like she would get too many more chances and hadn't already won one, so, and who looked like my mom, and I want to see somebody who looks like a mom on TV, so Brenda Fricker.
Okay. Well, she won the SmackDown, but I was curious if she would have actually won the most amount of votes, because it seemed like, you know, everybody was all over the place except for tied her with everyone. So she had no low ratings, which is how she pulled it off, basically. Did any of you feel that was a little, like, for me, I gave her the lowest rating, but I still thought she was very good. But Tasha had mentioned that it was kind of a one-note role, and for me it just wasn't exciting, so it feels a little weird to back, like, yes, that's an Oscar-winning performance.
Just to clarify, I said it was a one-note role for the Oscars, which is to say I don't think that there's anything wrong with it being a one-note role. I think sort of the flip side, the nicer way to say that is that it's consistent. Okay. But essentially, they gave her a role that's very calm. I think it was Todd said that she's kind of a rock in the storm, like a safe haven. And I think it's a very good performance. I was just a little surprised that it won the Oscar, because Oscar votes, especially for actresses, tend towards roles that are expressive. And there is no point where she freaks out and has a huge screaming meltdown. Mm-hmm. So when I say it's one note for the Oscars, I mostly just mean she's calm.
Okay. No, I totally hear you there, but that, and I feel a little ashamed of this because that's a great description of what they go for, but I actually wanted that a little more from her. I wanted like one last scene or one thing that would like totally define that, yes, this is who I would vote for.
Yeah, she never goes over the top. I mean, I guess I would see it as a role in one key, but it's kind of a very good, solid key. Mm-hmm. And it's all consistent within that key. Whereas if you take, say, Julia Roberts, I think there are a lot of notes in that performance, but they don't always kind of belong to the same key or even maybe the same character sometimes. Mm-hmm. So it's like, that's an example of a performance where you can play a lot of notes, but you've got to kind of make them all fit together.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which I actually thought was kind of my issue with Angelica Houston's performance as well.
I would say I am genuinely surprised as well that this won the Oscar. It's you know, you look at the most recent, you know, sort of supportive mom role that won, and it was Melissa Leo in The Fighter, which could not be a more different performance from this one.
Yeah.
I really liked Fricker's work here, but it's sort of interesting to me that all of these people got nominated and that then she became the consensus choice. I mean, I may not be remembering 1989 very well. Are there a lot of performances that got snubbed here, Nathaniel?
Well, that's actually a question I was going to ask people if they had anybody that they wish would have been here. The only one that I can remember specifically people getting behind that didn't really go anywhere was Laura San Giacomo for Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Yeah, definitely pushed for her.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah. And I personally was really into Bridget Fonda and Scandal that year. I know, Nick, you usually watch a lot of films for context. Did you have anyone else you would suggest?
I've been so like pre-TIFF oriented, I have not done a bunch of 1989ing, but I just did watch Scandal since she got the Globe nomination.
And
she was fine.
Okay,
I was more into Joanne Whalley Kilmer. Who knew? I didn't think I'd ever say that sentence. There you go.
Can I also put in a bit of a word for Amy Madigan in Field of Dreams? I think she's really pretty great in that, but I guess she'd had a chance quite recently, so, and maybe they considered it a lead, I guess. But
mm-hmm. I would have rooted for half of Steel Magnolias over Julia Roberts. Most specifically, I think Shirley MacLaine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, Steel Magnolias.
It's an honorary blush and bashful Oscar for all six of them.
That's what the SAG ensemble's for, but it was later when they came up with that. Okay, so I want to start with My Left Foot for the movies. And I know, Todd, you had mentioned that you misremembered the movie a little bit, mm-hmm. and that was definitely true for me as well. For whatever reason, I had lumped it into the category of the sort of musty biopics, mm-hmm. but it's actually really focused and really like fun in a weird way compared to how dire it could have played. I just think there's a lot of interesting stuff happening, and Nick, I loved your comment about how full every frame is, because even in like Steel Magnolias, for example, which is also a huge ensemble, it's like close-up, cut to close-up, cut to close-up. Like, it's not, you know, it's not working with how many characters there are.
Yeah.
This is Kevin. I kind of put three films sort of in a continuum, where you have Parenthood on the kind of low end, which, you know, is just so blocky. And there's just like, well, I mean, he does this, you know, Ron Howard, it just feels like he's just discovering the Steadicam in this film. And I remember like these shots where whoever he got for his cinematographer, Steadicam operator, is just like following Diane Wiest, you know, through the house, like from one door to the other, and it's just sort of busy for the sake of being busy. It's kind of show offy. It doesn't really convey anything ideal wise. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I feel Steel Magnolias has some very elegant camera movements that kind of connect different characters, especially in the beginning parts with the you know, when they were getting prepared for the wedding. But I think I prefer My Left Foot over both of them, just in terms of like what Nick was talking about, just the kind of the static. The camera doesn't move a lot, but there's a lot of movement in the frame.
Mm-hmm.
And especially Brenda Fricker, and this is something I brought up in my comments, just like she's always doing something even when she's, you know, delivering dialogue, she's either like making dinner or like cleaning the tables or just doing housework, and that just really speaks to you know, the state of this person's everyday existence in a way that isn't telegraphed. It's just there. So the part of that's the directing, part of that's the acting, and I think both of those are very it's great.
Yeah, it doesn't come across as business at all, what she's doing. It just comes across as authentically, like, this is how her life is. You know what?
And I also realized that, you know, I was, for some reason, watching this movie, I thought of John Ford for some reason. And then it just occurred to me now as we were talking that the real archetype for this role is Linda Darnell. Big difference. Jane Darwell. Jane Darwell in The Grapes of Wrath as Ma Jode.
I mean, or in fact, as Nick mentioned, also Sarah Allgood in How Green Was My Valley, I think you could throw in.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, it's like a Fordian archetype. And there's something kind of Fordian about this film. Fordian, not Freudian.
Mm-hmm. I really, like, was sort of surprised because I had sort of lumped this in mentally, even though I remembered liking it when I saw it. I'd lumped it in mentally with all of those movies in the 90s that were sort of like this person gets some sort of condition or disease or something, and then they suffer for a while, and then there's some triumph of the human spirit thing. And while this superficially fits that mold, it's so much more honest about Christie's condition and his life and his work, and so much more honest about, like, humor and all of the things that go into this. It's not, you know, Oscar bait schmaltz. It's very honest and real and lived in, and I really responded to that this time through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could you be referring to a particular film starring Robin Williams and Robert De Niro as a point of kind of negative comparison?
Oh, I don't know. I might be.
Although the frame story with the nurse, I mean, I know Christy Brown did wind up marrying one of his nurses, but the fact that we get kind of goosed to think of that entire relationship as having happened in one afternoon in a waiting room. Like, there is some, when the movie is willing to tilt towards schmaltz, I feel like it's often in that framing device, which makes it even more impressive to me that it's so resistant to that kind of goosing around the Fricker character or that relationship. There's not none, but there's so little.
Mm-hmm.
There's also sort of a cheat to that whole romantic story in that it seems like she doesn't engage with him. She engages with his book. Yeah. You know, she's sitting far across the room from him during most of those shots that we see. And she's reading the book. And when he talks to her, she looks uncomfortable. But then she goes back to the book and seems to kind of warm up again. And I think that there's a pretty clear message there of, okay, I can engage with this man because I'm not really engaging with what's in front of me. I'm engaging with, like, the life of his mind, the depth of his mind, and, like, the beauty of his art. And it's really disingenuous and a little gross, I think. Because, what it basically says is this guy is kind of repulsive, but I'm going to have a romance with him that has nothing to do with him. I think it's trying to make it palatable for the audience in a way. Mm. And I kind of feel the same way about the poster, which, if you look at the primary poster, it's...
I don't remember the poster at all.
Yeah, I remember it.
Go find it on the IMDb. It's a zoom-in of half of Daniel Day-Lewis's face. He's got, like, this thick, lustrous hair. He's clean-shaven. He's smiling. You can't see anything else. He's not doing, like, the lip overlap thing that he actually does throughout the movie. Uh-huh. And he looks like Jim Morrison on the Doors poster. Nothing like what he looks like in the movie.
Right. And this is a shot of Mary, whatever her name is, with the wine bottle and the glasses, right? And the
top.
Yeah.
I remember. Holding him up triumphantly.
Partly because of the positioning of the names on the top of the poster, it makes Brenda Fricker look like the left foot, essentially.
This is like this was a Miramax release, and this is like a classic late 80s, early 90s Miramax poster that just tries to, like, hide what the movie's about in favor of, like, making you think you're going to have a good time with attractive people.
Like those Oscar FYC ads that have everyone smiling even if the movie's like a tearjerker.
I don't know how you guys found this, but certainly over here, this film has always suffered from pretty bad home video treatment for a kind of, you know, double Oscar-winning important Irish film. It's had really bad DVD transfers and things from the ITV sourcing, and that's always been a bit of a problem for me because it serves to kind of exacerbate the kind of TV-ness of it in a way. I've always struggled to think of it as a kind of a proper movie. And I think maybe there is a Blu-ray now, some kind of import Blu-ray. I don't know how you guys saw it or how you found that affected your viewings.
Well, it shows here on Instant Watch, Netflix. I don't know if that's how everyone saw it, but I know people love streaming and everything, but I do not. I would rather have like the DVDs and Blu-rays of everything, just because I hate how the image basically feels like how VHS used to feel. Like there's always some loss to the image.
Well, as kind of disingenuous as the marketing was, like everybody was saying, that I was reading an interview with Brenda Fricker from a couple years ago when she was promoting Cloudburst, and she commented on how discontented the cast and the filmmakers actually were with the whole release pattern in the UK and in Ireland, where they felt like the movie never got a big shake and was sold as totally earnest and heavy, and that they felt like the movie has always been better received to include over the years since its release in the US. So as funny as the Weinstein promotion is, it does seem kind of indicative that even now in the UK, it sounds hard to get a...
That makes sense to me, actually. It's definitely been neglected.
Brent Fricker has a lot to say about a lot, so Google those interviews. She's not too worried about pissing anybody off.
The loss of work is not a concern.
Yeah.
So Enemy's a Love Story. I got the sense from your write-up, so I'm not completely sure that nobody liked this movie. Is that correct? Or does somebody want to
I liked it just fine. I mean, I think there's a lot of intelligent stuff going on. And, I mean, it's clear that there's a very interesting, very provocative novel that this movie is being based on. And yeah, it's a little, I guess, you know, gender, sexual, politics wise, I don't know. I mean, if you have no problems with Mad Men, why would you have a problem with this?
I have some problems with Mad Men.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, point taken.
Well, I have no problems with Mad Men, but I have a lot of problems with this. And Tim, in Tim's write-up, you said, you know, I love this because it's what was troubling me about Lena Olin. Like, why isn't that performance a total knockout? Because there are so many elements of it that are great. And you had said maybe she's crying out for more of a point of view, but I was unclear of whether you meant Masha or the actress herself.
I'm so interested in these three women, and I'm so kind of not interested in him. And it's like the movie even decides, and I'm sorry if this enters spoiler territory for any listeners who haven't seen it, but it even decides at the end that he just kind of gives up. But I just wish the film would actually give up on him sooner and let the evolving story with the wives actually take over. I feel as though this film could profit from just dropping that guy in the middle, and for the last sequence that we get to actually be the beginning of a whole third act, if you like.
Yeah. But do you think it's a casting issue? I just feel like Ron Silver just doesn't have much presence, especially when juxtaposed with, like, especially Houston and Olin, and he's just better off, you know, being like Bruce Willis's nemesis or something.
I kind of agree, and Nick and I had a bit of a conversation about this, but he is very unsympathetic. He's in that kind of, for me, a kind of Andy Garcia category of like struggling to care about this actor in most roles that he plays. Right. And that, given that the character is not very sympathetic to begin with, it kind of redoubles that problem. And I felt everything was being kind of filtered from his point of view, and I sort of wanted to rebel against that somehow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also the conversations he has, there's all this prodding stuff in the script where he keeps asking Angelica's character in particular, like, have you ever thought about sleeping with a woman, or how would you feel about sleeping with a woman or a relationship with a woman? And so we end up with this kind of punchline at the end, which seems to have established. But I just feel as though it's not enough for that just to be a punchline, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
I feel really like I agree with this, that Ron Silver is a lot of the problem here. It feels like also, though, that I haven't read this book, but certainly the structure of the script and you know, the summary I've read of the book, they seem very similar. When you have these books where it's like sort of a bland central character has a bunch of interesting people in his or her life,
mm-hmm.
like that can work on the page, because we don't have to look at the bland central character all the time. We're just sort of seeing what they see and hearing their occasional thoughts. But on screen, we're necessarily having to see this sort of guy who's there, and that just is all never as interesting. It's sort of weirdly, and this is the worst comparison ever, but it reminded me of the first couple Harry Potter movies, where like Harry Potter is not the most interesting character in those, and those movies were not very good because he's just this bland nothing at the mm-hmm. center. But right. but also I think Ron Silver gets into this thing you get into in movies like this where the one actor is sort of outmatched by everybody around him, so their performances become more inconsistent because they're constantly sort of trying to push against, you know, the lack of center that the movie has.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I still feel like a strong actor could really carry this through, and just, you know, in this sort of revisionist history that's I'm going through my mind, it's like who at that time could have carried it off, and the first person that comes to mind is Michael Douglas for some reason, because he kind of does that in Basic Instinct. Like, he's not that kind of alpha, and mm-hmm. you know, it's really Sharon Stone that is really the alpha in that movie. And well,
I mean, this maybe because Lena Olin was there, I couldn't help but think about Unbearable Lightness of Being. Mm. Because Daniel Day-Lewis was juggling women in that.
Right.
But Daniel Day-Lewis is so riveting as an actor that he could, you know, you can have all these fantastically interesting people around him, but you still have, like, the sturdiest center, you know? And I did think that was a huge problem with this movie. Like, I wanted to like the character because I'm not against, you know, unsympathetic characters as leads, but I just couldn't.
Right.
You know, it, like, the women were so interesting, and I felt like the movie knew that in a way, but couldn't yeah. commit to it.
Right. And I kind of wonder if that's why, like, Lena Olin's character just comes off as somewhat incoherent. It's like, if you put the person that ought to be playing opposite her, for her to be acting the way she is, mm-hmm. it would make a lot more sense. So I don't know. Somehow, in my mind, I just kind of, like, was able to make that separation. Just like, okay, well, this is her playing, I don't know, just trying to, like, convey what the movie wants her character to convey, you know, mm-hmm. regardless of what's actually coming through from her co-star. And it just,
I'd like to hear from Tasha actually about that character, because you had a real problem with the way the movie kind of treats that character in some respect, or that, you know, how thankless that role seemed. And for me, it was the Yadwiga role that was the really thankless one.
Oh yeah,
the actress is kind of forced into all kinds of kind of dodgy scene playing. But I just wondered if you had a similar problem with that character as well.
I thought it was a similarly thankless character, but I thought it was a much more interesting thankless character, because there was a sense that she had a journey to take. I mean, she's so naive, and she's so unfit for American society. You know, the point keeps being made that she's kind of living in this old world mentality where she's a servant and a peasant, and people keep calling her a peasant. And she really needs to kind of find her own identity outside of her husband and her, you know, sense of being a servant from the old world. And I found that a lot more interesting than the way Masha is just sort of this histrionic, over-the-top manipulator who pretty much has nothing to say except abandon everybody else and be with me, but then doesn't actually seem to want him all that much. Like, my biggest problem with her was just sort of a sense of not really having any idea who she was or what she wanted, besides kind of a damaged sense of clinging to whatever was in front of her. And I feel like ultimately the moral of this story is just the Holocaust damaged everybody. Like, even the survivors are all deeply, deeply damaged, which is, I think, in some ways a more interesting Holocaust story than so many Holocaust stories have been told, and so many of them follow the same patterns. This is a post-Holocaust story where everybody in the movie is basically coming from this place of immense, immense trauma. And I think what was most interesting to me about it is the entirely different ways they express it. But I found Jadwiga's like naivete and hiding in the past kind of more interesting, and leaving her with more places to go than Masha's just kind of being a terrible person. The whole movie, I felt, was I feel like this film wouldn't exist if Sophie's Choice hadn't been such an award winner. And this just, I mean, I know it's based on a Isaac Bashevis Singer book, but it still feels like, let's just take Sophie's Choice and multiply it by five or six and see if that wins like five or six times as many awards. And the whole thing felt constricted and Oscar baity and artificial to me, like without the life that Sophie's Choice had.
Nick, you haven't said much, and I'm curious because I know you do not like Sophie's Choice very much. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like I find Sophie's Choice a little more mercenary in trying to sort of pump its character for her confessions and also kind of romanticize and exoticize her, partially because we're filtered through that Stingo character who's determined to do that and see her as a premise on which he can stake his literary career. Whatever, I will back away from Sophie's Choice, but I agree with people who are talking about the which is, I guess, everybody, about the weird inconsistencies not only between these performances, but sometimes within them. And I really had a question just about direction. That it seemed like Paul Mazursky had told each of these three actresses that we're going to do a dramatic rendering of this novel, but I also want to make it kind of light and capture some of the black kind of mordant comedy in Singer. But they have really different relationships to what the lightness or comedic aspect of the movie should be, whether it, you know, some of them are kind of, I responded to Jadwiga's kind of slapsticky more often than I wish, and Tim mentioned that tendency, I think, in Angelica Houston's performance a little bit, that she might be going for kind of goosing the movie with some kind of charm and personality rather than playing to the more difficult emotions that are in it sometimes, which I agreed with about Houston, but even more agree with about Mazursky. Like, I think this was a really strange, I like the ambition of it, but it was a strange tonal gambit to bring to this story that it's so...
From the music on in, really, right?
Yes, I mean, exactly.
And you know who, you know, I just Googled this, because the person I imagine was probably considered for the main role is Richard Dreyfuss, and it turns out it was offered to him. And he would have definitely tried to get more comedy into that role. But I don't know if he'd have succeeded in resolving that sympathy problem that we had.
Right. It makes sense, because you look at Out in Beverly Hills,
it still
has this kind of like dry, deadpan, kind of sarcastic
quality. Apparently he had a big falling out with Mazursky, and that's why he didn't get the role.
But I mean, he has a lot more natural charisma as a star, though, so I think it would have been quite a different movie, though. But yeah, I had the problems with the comedy, too, because I wanted to, as Nick was saying, I wanted to enjoy the ambition of it as being a comedy, even though it's about trauma, but it just couldn't... It was so tonally inconsistent, and not just. And I'm okay with tone shifting throughout movies, but it just seemed like even within scenes, it didn't know. You know, do you want this to be funny or not?
Yeah, that's what I felt. And I thought Lena Olin had the kind of surest sense, from my perspective, of how to make things funny or give things an ironic slant in her line readings or her physicality or something without kind of rupturing you out of the scene. Like, if the direction had had the same key that her performance had, I think I would like the movie even more.
Mm-hmm. Ron Silver also just has this kind of innate humorlessness. I mean, whenever he's flashing back to his time in the barn with the dogs coming up, there's just this like deadly... I mean, it's like the most emotional beats of Fisher King without any of the lightness around those emotional beats. That kind of sense of, you know, darkness is coming for you. And that's why one of the reasons why my favorite part of this film was Angelica Houston, was just sort of a sense that, like, once she gets her feet under her, you get a couple of scenes that show just how raw and hurt she is and how difficult she's finding kind of coming back to life after this deadly time. But then she kind of suits up and puts on this persona of this, you know, very elegant European lady, and she becomes very funny in a way that's not excessive or over the top or exaggerated. It's a little bit camp, but it's deliberately camp because she's creating this character for herself. And the character that she's created is the sophisticate who's above it all. And as a coping mechanism, I just found that so much more interesting than tearing other people apart, which is, you know, what Lena Olin's character's doing.
Tasha, that's a really great point, and that almost makes me want to change my grade of Angelica Houston.
Yeah, I agree with that totally, yeah.
Yeah, and also, Tasha, I just want to thank you for the millionaire pondering which home to sell line, because that was just really funny, because it is, the problem with not having a charismatic lead is the juggling of lovers can feel really, like, really, this is your problem in life, you know?
I know, when my colleague Nathan Rabin over at The Dissolve, Don John came out, I found it to be a very interesting and funny movie about somebody, you know, juggling different love interests and trying to figure out what he wanted to do with his life. And Nathan said, I really don't ever want to see that movie because my least favorite genre in the world is the handsome, charismatic man whose major problem is he just has way too much sex. And I feel the same way about stories that are just about somebody whose primary problem in life is too many love interests and trying to sort out between them, particularly when it's something like Reality Bites, where the love interests are just patently symbolic. You know, do I choose authenticity or do I choose like wealth and comfort? Or there's a whole genre of anime called harem that is exactly like this movie, where you have a super, super bland protagonist surrounded by very, very colorful women who are all interested in him. And he just kind of gets bounced like a ping pong ball between them and not only can't make any kind of decision for himself, but can't really evince much of a personality. And that's when the center of your movie, his primary choice is which one of these people who is way more interesting than me do I validate with my attention? That's a real problem. I mean, I'm glad he disappeared from the film. I wish he'd done it much earlier.
Yeah, I agree.
Right. I think that one of the reasons Houston was my favorite of the performances here is because she does, you know, as you guys have, Tasha has mentioned, she creates this interesting character, but that also helps with some of the movie's tonal problems. Like, she sort of rises above them, and I have that problem with a lot of Mazursky, that question of tone. I really like some of his films, but a lot of other ones I feel like he sort of is trying to do too much at once. And I feel like Houston really locked into the tone of some other version of the movie that made a lot more sense. And she was always, you know, sort of, it's almost, she almost works as a parallel to Brenda Fricker here to me in that she's always grounded in what that movie is. And I always feel like I'd rather be watching whatever she's starring in than what everybody else is.
Particularly bearing in mind, she's the one, in a way, she's playing the most tragic character. She's the one who's lost her children. Mm-hmm. And yet she brings more light to the role than anyone else does. I think mm-hmm. she manages to play against it more successfully for me.
Hmm. I guess I feel slightly defensive on Lena Olin's behalf that even agreeing with all these points, I feel like she too is playing somebody who has adopted. And Kevin, you kind of, I wonder if you were indicating something like this when you talked about her associations with Hayworth and Bacall and the kind of 40s star persona that either the actress or the character seems to be cultivating. Because I feel like, in my viewing of the movie, we are watching Jadwiga and Tamara decide, as Tasha and others have said, what tactic they're going to follow to cope with both the current circumstance but also their own path, the past. But Lena Olin's character, I feel like, has already made that decision before the movie has started, is going for this kind of temptress figure that she may seems to associate with being in America in some way, because she has many recourses to talking about that. And then we watch a decision that's already been made as the character subtly goes back and forth about whether or not it's working or whether she's into it or whether this is really going to pan out, which by the end it doesn't. And I admired the challenge that every actress was in here, but I don't think she's in a totally different movie. I just think she's in a different place in the timeline of...
Yeah.
Trying to keep up a role.
Right. It's a way more gymnastic performance in the sense that, yeah, her character arc has way more contortions. And I think it's easier to praise Houston or Fricker for that matter, just because their characters have a steadier arc and they're older characters, more kind of worldly wise. Whereas Olin's character is just, yeah, she's in the thick of it and she's really putting on different kind of behavioral strategies just to try to get something out of this guy. Mm-hmm. And it's almost, I don't know, I almost wonder if there's like a meta layer to it in terms of, you know, Lena Olin having to act across from Von Silver and trying to get something out of, you know, get something out of that dynamic. Mm-hmm.
I really liked her work because I felt that she had, this is why I'd asked him about the point of view he mentioned, because I really felt that Masha had a very specific, that Lena Olin had given her a very specific point of view. It was extremely nihilistic underneath all the dazzle, because, you know, it's like kind of like the sort of romance that's meant to go down with the ship. Like, I actually think she's planning suicide all the time.
Mm. I really like her too, and in a way, it feels like she should be the main character. That's sort of what I mean, I guess, in that there's, she has more... Her performance has more dimension than either of the other two wives, if you like. And yet she's still... We're still only really hanging out with her when the mood strikes Ron Silver to go and visit her. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wanted to know how she was functioning when she wasn't with him, you know, mm-hmm. and we have to guess that, and she does very well to kind of give you some idea of that, mm-hmm. but I'd like to have seen it.
Right. There's this one moment that I keep coming back to when they kind of have a falling out, and it's like underneath the elevated train, you know, somewhere in Brooklyn, and she basically like walks out on him, but then like several paces later, she stops dead in her tracks, and there's this like look that flashes across her eye, and then she just sort of comes, you know, softly back, and she's the one that takes him in her arm as they walk as this couple. And I don't know, there's like so much going on in terms of, you know, how do I play this moment, or how do I play this, you know, and just the degree of agency that she has. It's almost like she is the stealth lead in the movie.
Yeah,
in terms of dictating where the relationship is going, and just pushing as far as she can until she can't anymore.
Mm-hmm. One place you really see that, and what I thought was easily the most interesting thing about both the performance and the characters, is how she responds to the sex scenes. The fact that her eyes are almost always open, and she's almost always looking sort of off screen, you can see that, you know, she's really not giving herself into the sensuality of whatever moment, even though she's the one who has a tendency to push into those moments, then you can see her kind of mentally stepping out of them. And sex becomes very performative for her in a way that really shapes the character. Because, you know, you really have a sense, I think, that she's not really that into him. Or at least she's not into what they do together in bed. Maybe she's into the company and like the sense of ownership she has. I really wish that there'd been a little more specificity in terms of what she actually gets out of the relationship. But I was fascinated with the fact that the movie actually spends more than a little time with the two of them together in bed, and she always seems like once she gets him there, she just goes elsewhere and stays there.
Right, and there's the mystery. There's another moment where I think they reflect on what happened to them in the camps, and I forget the specific line, but she said something about, you know, were there men involved? Were men trying to come on to her? And I think she said there was some officer or something, but then, you know, nothing happened. Almost like, you know, and you just get this sense of a denial. Like, it's like all this trauma and stuff that she just put behind her. And just her
isn't that Angelica Houston that gives that speech?
They both have a version of that speech.
Angelica has the one where she says there were like three guys, and then she kind of actually says, actually, there were no guys. I've been making that up. So that there is this sense that they're all playing around with their past to try and kind of make themselves either to make Silver's character jealous or to make him feel more comfortable or whatever it is. They're acting a role.
Yeah, and there's so many layers of subtext, just what you just said. And it's like, all right, Paul Mazursky, pick one.
They both have scenes like that, and they both also play off that whole I'm not dead, I'm not alive thing. And it seems like, yeah, because they're not, Mazursky's not choosing, it feels very like mandated that you know, they are specific types, and that they are reflections of each other and all that. So I think there are a lot of issues with the movie, but it is an interesting movie, so I would suggest if people are interested in this conversation that they check it out. That's the end of part one, our discussion of My Left Foot and Enemies, A Love Story. I'm your host, Nathaniel R. In part two, we'll be discussing two very big hits of 1989, Parenthood and Steel Magnolias, and that's coming right up. And once again, thanks to the guests, Tasha Robinson from The Dissolve, Todd Vanderwerf from Vox, Kevin B. Lee from Keyframe, Tim Roby from The Telegraph, Nick Davis from Nix Flick Picks. See you in part two.